AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. Police release more information about Friday's shooting inside a high school near Denver. AP Radio's Ed Donahue has more.
Sheriff Grayson Robinson looked at security video from the school. He says gunman Carl Pearson did not hide his weapons as he walked into Arapahoe High.
The individual also had a bandolera of multiple rounds of shotgun ammunition strapped across his body. And he was also armed with a machete.
Robinson adds the weapon used was bought legally.
The shooter purchased the shotgun on December 6th at a local retail outlet.
A student and a teacher say Pearson had strong political views and was kicked off the school's speech and debate team. I'm Ed Donahue.
After all the pomp and ceremony and honors by heads of state from around the globe, Nelson Mandela has been laid to rest following a simple graveside prayer.
Rest in peace. Yours was truly a long walk to freedom. And now you have achieved the ultimate freedom in the bosom of your maker.
Mandela is buried near the eastern South African village of his childhood. Many people who get their health insurance through their workplace blame the president's health care law for increasing premiums, higher copays, and deductibles. An AP GFK poll finds that close to half of those questioned who already have health insurance say their policies will change next year and not for the better. A foot or more of snow has already fallen in central Pennsylvania, and the storm is now moving into New England. There have been travel problems because of the storm, including the cancellation of about 1,000 flights yesterday and another 200 today. Forecasters say up to a foot of snow may fall in Massachusetts and Maine. This is AP Radio News. Jameis Winston is the landslide winner of the Heisman Trophy. The Florida State quarterback, second straight freshman to win the award. Alabama quarterback A.J. McCarron placed second, some 1,500 points behind Winston. Winston and Florida State will face Auburn in the BCS title game next month. Navy extends its winning streak to 12 straight over Army. Ed Benkin has more on that annual football classic from Philadelphia.
It was all Navy in the 114th Army Navy game as the midshipmen rolled to a 34-7 victory. It was 17-0 Navy at the half with the help of a 47-yard touchdown run by Keenan Reynolds. It was 20-7 Navy after three quarters when Reynolds scored again from 11 yards out and added a catch on a two-point conversion. Reynolds would score one more time on a one-yard run. The Navy quarterback finished with 136 yards rushing, part of 343 total yards by Navy on the ground. Navy wins it over Army 34-7. Ed Benkin, Philadelphia.
I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
Do you miss the joy of reading because of blindness or disability? Here's great news about Choice Magazine Listening, a free talking magazine. You'll hear outstanding articles and stories chosen from leading publications such as The New Yorker, National Geographic, Smithsonian, Time, Sports Illustrated, and many more. Please call 1-888-7-CHOICE or on the web www.choicemagazinelistening.org.
Losing more than just spare change in your laundry? By upgrading your old washer to an energy-efficient model, you can save up to $625 over the washer's lifetime. The DC Sustainable Energy Utility offers discounts and rebates on energy-efficient lighting and appliances that can save you energy and money. Last year, the DCSU served 19,000 district households through renewable and efficient energy services. Call 202-479-2222 or visit dcseu.com to start saving money and energy today. Losing more than just spare change in your laundry? By upgrading your old washer to an energy-efficient model, you can save up to $625 over the washer's lifetime. The DC Sustainable Energy Utility offers discounts and rebates on energy-efficient lighting and appliances that can save you energy and money. Last year, the DCSU served 19,000 district households through renewable and efficient energy services. Call 202-479-2222 or visit dcseu.com to start saving money and energy today.
Hello, this is Peter Bergman. Please join WTOP, Bergman's Cleaning, and the Salvation Army for the 22nd annual Share the Warmth Coats for Kids and the Needy. If you have one or more cold weather coats, please donate them for this worthy cause by calling Bergman's Cleaning. Bergman's will clean and deliver them to the Salvation Army for distribution to the needy in the Washington metro area. Thanks to you, over 500,000 coats have been collected since 1991. Make this year's coat drive a success by calling Bergman's at 703-247-7600. Thank you.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the offices of Bernhardt Wealth Management, serving as your chief financial officer and helping make work optional for you. We have a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Brian Karlish, who's the co-founder and CEO of Buchanan and Edwards, Wayne Beekman, co-founder of Information Concepts, Vijay Lakshman, the president of Brilliant Entertainment, and Mark Chichester, the president of Atlas Research. First up is Brian Karlish, who's the co-founder and CEO of Buchanan Edwards. What is Buchanan and Edwards?
Hi, Buchanan and Edwards is a systems integrator. We focus on bringing technology solutions to our federal government customers, finding ways to improve their mission performance and bring efficiency and effectiveness to their mission.
So, well, give us an example of a real-life scenario that you've helped through your company.
Absolutely. Just recently, we helped the State Department. A number of their embassies were running. They've been impacted by sequestration. They've had to reduce their staff. We delivered a custom application that was able to enhance and improve their current workflow and do effectively take replace the job of 9 folks that were doing manual processes with electronic submissions.
When was the company founded, Brian?
1998.
And how big or small are you today?
We are about 220 employees.
Okay. Why start a company?
I wanted to make a difference. My co-founders and I, Greg and Tony Parchment, we really believed in the mission of the federal government, wanted to make an impact, get engaged, loved technology, wanted to really make a difference with the way our federal government was delivering solutions to its citizens.
And why make a difference in the federal government? Why not just in the private sector where you could be equally impactful?
Had worked in the private sector before starting the company and just found the mission not to be exciting. And frankly, the federal government mission, growing up as a kid, a military brat, traveling around the world, seeing, I've had the great fortune of living in a number of different countries, and just really believe in the great experiment that is the United States, and just excited to have an ability to have an impact. I mean, Washington, D.C., we're the center of the universe right now, and the stuff that we do, the work that we are engaged in, is having a real-world impact to millions of people around the world.
Brian, where did that belief get instilled in you?
I think, I was a political science major as an undergrad, always appreciated government, always fascinated by policy, the impact of government, and growing up again overseas and in that military family, my father was also engaged with the diplomatic corps through his work with NATO, and just getting to see that aspect of kind of being in a foreign country and recognizing the differences between the host country that I was at and our country, just gave me a real appreciation for the United States of America and how we do things. And for me, having that impact with technology, which at the time, 98, it was just starting to explode, and the possibilities that technology can bring, just changing the way services are delivered was really inspiring to me.
What is it about technology that's so fascinating to you, and how did you get interested in it?
I think it's just, I've always been a gadget guy. I've always been interested in the newest and late, early adopter. I actually was one of the first people, I think, to buy a car on the internet back in 1996 with Autobytel. And people thought I was crazy, but I've always been an early adopter with technology, and I've always found that technology has just been a really creative enabler of new ways of doing things and solving problems.
What surprised you most when you started the company?
I think myself and my partners were pretty young. We were in our late 20s, and I think it was just a bunch of hubris and ignorance, thinking it was going to be easy. I remember I was with worked at a company and had approached one of the executives there to come join us, and he said, "Oh, you want to go from a 40-hour week to an 80-hour week?" And I said, "You're crazy. I'm going to be going to a 30-hour week." And I soon learned that was misguided. So I think more hard work than I ever anticipated and appreciated.
Was ever there a moment of doubt that, oh, my God?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've taken the company to the, as I like to say, we've driven the car, you know, with one wheel on the road and everything else off to fall off the cliff. But I wouldn't trade it for the world. I would encourage anybody listening to, you know, if you have that dream, to go for it. I think you learn more about yourself than anything else you could achieve. You could pursue.
I'd like to follow through on that piece, though. Was there anybody else actually telling you at that time that, no, you shouldn't be doing this, you're crazy?
Everybody. Everybody was telling us we were crazy. Parents. I mean, we had a great career going. We had great great possibilities with.
So what is it about you that just basically says, forget that?
Yeah, I think I've always been very driven to achieve. If I set my mind to something, I'm apt to accomplish that. And particularly if the more people that say no, it can't be done, then I think that's just more.
Can you remind us of perhaps a story where actually you demonstrated that to the nth degree?
Yeah, I've done that a number of times. One time when I was younger, I actually was able to go from when I was a junior in high school. I was able to travel a lot, but I did come back to the United States and finish my senior year here locally. That was a big challenge. My parents were still overseas. When I was in college, I had to put myself through school. I had to find jobs to achieve that. And then also, my first job, I went to go work for a management consulting firm, but being a political science major, they didn't want. I was in the wrong major, and the school wasn't going to let me interview, but I found ways to sneak around, get into the interview pipeline, and mm-hmm. then ultimately get a job.
It's almost like an act of defiance for you.
Yeah, well, hopefully it's not a negative
word. I don't want to use that as a negative word. But
you're right. I do think I think my family and friends would see that as right. I'm not going to be proven wrong.
So you speak about this, you know, learning that the United States is really kind of a special place. You call it the grand experiment by actually being overseas and seeing something else. When did it dawn on you that this place is really unique?
I think it was in my early 20s. I was visiting relatives over in Germany, and a lot of my cousins did not have good career aspirations. They were sort of in this malaise. The economy was pretty tough, and yet here I was in the United States. It was the mid-90s. The internet was exploding. People in my generation were starting software companies. It just seemed to be with unlimited possibilities. And I do believe in this country, you know, people can come over here as first-generation Americans and achieve great things. And there's nothing that's prohibiting you from going forward.
So what's it like to lead a company through the time of uncertainty most government contractors are experiencing now?
It is challenging. I'll say that this is probably the most difficult time, certainly in my career. And I think what's difficult is having that, you know, what I need to share with my employees and my customers is the belief that, hey, we'll get through this. It is a great opportunity for us to sort of redefine how work is being done. Again, technology has there is a great opportunity for technology to be a big part of this solution. It is an enormous fiscal crisis that our country is in.
How do you go about keeping an employee motivated that, given all these gyrations on the federal budget side, may not have a job?
That's challenging. I definitely have to convince, you know, share with them that they need to always be on top of their game. They need to be bringing new skills to the table. They've got to be very proactive about their careers. I also need to share with them that, you know, look at the long term. You're going to have an impact. Think about how you're going to look back on your career when you're in your 80s and you want to know that you had an impact. Now's the time to make a difference. It's when the chips are down that you can most make the difference.
How big do you want to get as a company?
A great question. I think it's important to grow. My employees need growth. I need to give them career opportunities, leadership opportunities in the management side or the technology side. And, you know, again, frankly, looking back, when I'm older, I want to know that we had a real impact and made a difference. And I think taking on larger and more hairy problems for the government is what it's going to take. So we're going to have to get bigger.
But don't you put that personal relationship you seem to have with your employees at risk if you get bigger?
We do, and it's a challenge. But again, back to technology, leveraging social media and ways to engage employees. But it's tough. It is a personal touch, and I do appreciate that.
How do you spend the bulk of your day today as CEO?
It's a mix. I'm very focused on growth, and so it's engaging partners, engaging customers, looking at new opportunities, problems that are out there that we can solve.
Other than mom and dad, talk about some important influences along the way.
Oh, gosh. You know, in addition to my parents, it would have to be, you know, folks that I've worked for, you know, strong leaders.
It's the one person that stands out the most that, you know, because I met this person, I'm this guy.
I think it was a good friend of mine's father, Ray Lancaster. He was a VP of government affairs here locally in the Washington, D.C. area. And I think I always looked to him. He was also an English professor before that. And I just always admired his ability to make that transition from academia into government affairs. And he was passionate about politics. He was passionate about policy. And I think he had a big influence on sort of how I looked at government, what government can do for its citizens, and sort of our role as America in the global community.
All right. What's the toughest thing you've ever accomplished?
Oh, God. Shoot.
There's so many.
Yes. Well, no, it's I mean, you know, I have a wonderful family. I think having children, I think being young and starting a business and then having kids, again,
balancing it all.
Balancing it all was a challenge. And
yeah.
Being able to, and the company is another family, and it requires the attention of a child, and you can never give enough.
How do you balance it all?
It's difficult. There's definitely sacrifices that are made on both sides. I think, you know, sometimes I'm shortchanging my family, and then sometimes I'm shortchanging the company, and sometimes I'm shortchanging my customers, but yeah. It's hard.
You've had two partners through the whole time of the company.
Correct.
Right? What's the key to success with partners?
I think lots of communication. We talk daily. It's a forced conversation. We do a daily huddle in the morning, and I think having that loop, constantly talking, it's like a marriage, and being engaged.
I just want to kind of wrap a theme that I see coming out of the conversation, this thing about believing in yourself and making things happen. Where did that come from for you? When did you actually realize that you actually could believe in yourself enough to go do what you did?
Yeah, I think it has to probably go back to sports. Sports and the fact that I was moving every 2 years for school. You know, I'd have to restart and re-engage with a new group of friends, a new environment I was unfamiliar with, new teachers, new classmates. And I think recognizing I could get through that every 2 years, and then also at sports, having the perseverance to make the team, to work hard to get on the team, I think showed me that put your mind to something, you can get it done.
So never guarantee the outcome, but you were persistent that way.
I'd rather give it my best shot and try for it and fail than to not have tried at all.
Great. What's the website address, Brian?
We are www.buchanan-edwards.com.
One more time?
Buchanan-edwards.com.
Great. We've been speaking with Brian Karlish, co-founder and CEO of a company called Brian and Edwards. I'd like to thank Les Mullen for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this business call.
Joining us for this business spotlight is Lee Self, president and owner of Renaissance Executive Forums. Lee, what is Renaissance Executive Forums?
Renaissance Executive Forums is a group of business owners and CEOs who come together and learn from each other's real life experiences in business.
And what do clients appreciate most about Renaissance Executive Forums?
The ability to come together in a real high trust environment and have their thinking challenged by others who have been where they are.
Why is trust so important?
Because these folks, you know, they run businesses, they have a lot of employees who depend on them, and they're expected to have all the answers, and yet they don't. So they need a place where they can go and kind of let their hair down and talk about the things they're uncertain of.
What does your perfect client look like?
Perfect client would be an individual who's running a very successful, stable business, maybe has 100 employees, and is restless with where they are, and looking to move maybe to the next level, growing, or looking to move in a different direction, and knowing that they don't have all the answers.
What do you enjoy most about your work?
What I enjoy most about my work is sitting back and watching them help each other in ways I could never imagine, because they get each other.
Interesting. They get each other.
Yeah.
And you don't have to do the work for them.
No, I just get to, the most important thing I do is bring great members into the forum.
What's the website?
www.executiveforums.com.
Thank you for listening to this Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Bernhardt Wealth Management Firm, helping to make work optional for you. I'm Peter Schwartz as the host, and my co-host is Les Mullen. For this segment, we have Wayne Beekman, who is the co-founder of a company called Information Concepts. What is Information Concepts, Wayne?
We're a fixed-price custom software development shop.
Fixed-priced custom development software shop. What does that mean to the layman?
When you think about software development, we kind of think about it as you'd build a house, right? You wouldn't build a house without a blueprint. So we actually help our customers create that blueprint through our planning process. That blueprint then gives them a fixed project plan and price to build the application.
Right. When was the company founded?
We started in 1982.
And how big or small today?
We're about 50 folks.
So isn't fixed price a little risky?
Absolutely. Yes.
So why do you do it?
You know, we've kind of broke the code pretty early on. We felt that if we can get the stakeholders in the room and help them create a visualization of what the system that they're envisioning, similar to a blueprint, then everyone has the same mind's eye view. And if everyone has the same mind's eye view, we can then document the requirements and put a project plan and deliver.
So would you say you got good at doing that and then you were able to do the fixed price concept?
We got good. We're everyone's a great developer. You know, everyone has great, especially in the D.C. area, we're a lot of talented developers. What makes us special is really that process to be able to extract requirements, get requirements right the first time.
How did you come about the process? Did you intuitively know we needed it, or did you kind of fail along until you got there?
Fear
of what?
So I was working on a project downtown in an agency, and a customer asked to bid on a project. And I wrote two options on a piece of paper. I said, we could have this many people for this many months, or we can do it for this price. I was 23 years old, and he pointed to the fixed price and said, build it for that. So we had to. So what we did is we got our stakeholders in the room, and today we use very sophisticated visualization tools. Back in 1984, we used a whiteboard and basically had the stakeholders, we drew out screens on the board. Once they were happy with it, we documented them and built.
When did you realize you wanted to be a software developer? How young?
I was in seventh grade in 1971. And
in seventh grade, you started writing code?
Yep, basic.
What was going on that that brought this about?
I was very lucky. I was in a high school in Long Island, West Hempstead, and I walked into the computer room in seventh grade, and it just spoke to me.
Well, there's a lot of ways for us to interact with computers.
Right.
You're writing code.
Right.
Why go that deep? I mean, you were fascinated with the whole thing?
It just worked. I mean, I would sit there. I would type what I want to type. It would come back. I could tell it what to do. It would work.
Were you good at it?
I was great at it. I still am.
Yeah. Wow.
I always say I'm a recovering developer.
You had said something earlier when we were in the green room about that used the phrase being left alone. There was something that appealed to you about walking in that room, seeing this stuff and saying, this is me.
Well, when you're, seventh grade of the shortest kid in seventh grade of a school that has seventh to 12th graders on Long Island, being safe is a good attribute. So walking in to a computer, I was kind of being facetious, yeah. But, it really did. It was very satisfying.
Uh-huh. So growing up in Long Island, what was that like?
Oh, we had a lot of fun. It was a great place to. It's a great place to be from.
Uh huh. You have brothers and sisters?
I have an older brother, three years older.
So you're the youngest?
Yes.
What was that like?
It's fine. He did his own thing. I did my own thing, and we realized that after college that we actually had brothers.
And mom and dad, what were they doing?
My father was in the printing business in Manhattan, and my mother was a school teacher.
What'd you learn from your dad?
Not to have a long commute. That's for one thing. He would get up at 5:30 in the morning and drive into Manhattan into what is now Soho, and in the printing business and worked a long day and spent a lot of time driving back.
Did you get a work ethic from him? What'd you pick up from your dad?
Yeah, it was one customer at a time. In fact, in the back of his business card, he had a line that said "Through service we grow." And I think today I kind of think about that.
And how about your mom?
She was great. She was worked for local schools, so she was around and has been very supportive.
How'd you find yourself in D.C.?
I went to GW late 70s. Mm-hmm. I thought I'd get away from New Yorkers by coming to GW, but I clearly didn't do my research. I went to GW and
what'd you major in?
I was a poli-sci major for 2 weeks until I found that you could actually study development. So I actually went into the business school in information science.
Uh-huh. And your first job out of college?
I worked for MCI, which was a local startup back in the day. I was employee 382 of MCI.
Yeah, tell us a great story about one of your experiences there.
A great story is we were moving into the new headquarters building in 19th Street, and I was going up the elevator with this old guy holding a bunch of blueprints and telling him how excited I was going to move into the office next week, and he showed me a cubicle. At the end, I realized it was Bill McGowan, the
founder of MCI.
Yeah, great guy.
What do you remember most about that experience?
It was brutal. It was a corporate environment that was growing very fast. They gave multiple executives the same task, and they would see who would do it first. It gave me the ability to show how you can use code to solve business problems. And I also learned a lot from, in terms of my shop. I remember the first day I showed up, I sat in the room and nobody talked to me. There was no interaction. I remember calling the woman who hired me and said, "Do you remember me? You know, you offered me a job." So today, something that I always do is make sure that the first day someone shows up to work, everything's set up, we have a place for them, we take them out to lunch, we make them feel welcome.
Those are pretty heady times in the history of telecom. Right. What was it like to be at the front end of all that?
When you're in it, you don't realize it. Oh. I was a programmer, so I did the original tariff simulations to help MCI figure out rate bands. All I did was, you know, I wrote a lot of code and they came up with a lot of numbers. But, you know, when I think back about the impact, it was pretty tremendous.
Well, take us back. What was the impact?
The problem was, how do you compete against AT&T,
right?
And be able to still provide service. And what I showed through simulations is how to price their rate bands in order to be profitable given traffic patterns.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty impactful thing to do.
Right.
What was it? Did you realize at the time you were making a difference that way?
No, I was just up at 5 a.m. writing a lot of code, and I was I was just a kid.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, is it the work itself that you get the gratification from, or is this theme of breaking the code? And I mean, as Pete was saying, in the 70s back then, you were at the forefront of what was a burgeoning industry with MCI, mm-hmm. and you were writing programs and codes and showing them how to solve business problems that way through an approach that didn't exist before that. I mean, this is...
When I was at UW... I needed to get out of the big Thurston Hall dorm to be able to have a kitchen. And in order to do that, I went to the Center for the Creative Process. You know, who was a business guy in the Center for Creative Process. It got me a kitchen. And they would bring artists in to not talk about their art, but they would talk about their process behind the art. And a woman called Clotilde Woodward Smith, who is an architect from the 60s and 70s of D.C., came to the class. And she said, "The way I know that my process worked is that I have a mind's eye view of a project before I start. And at the end, to the percentage that my mind's eye view is realized is how well I've done." That's what we actually do today.
Hmm.
We start with the planning effort, we get a vision, and what we get excited about is actually delivering.
So back then you knew that this was an approach, a way to look at things in order to figure out how to get done what needs to be done.
It was basically verbalizing, you know, the process that we were doing.
So that's really what you do, is just engage the creative process, and you've got good at it so that you can make a pretty big bet on what the cost will be?
Right, and manage our resources.
So talk to us about the creative process. What goes on during that thing that people think is so easy, but actually it's fairly robust?
The hardest part is getting stakeholders, business folks, and IT folks to work together.
Mm-hmm.
We do that through workshops, drawing things on the board, and immediately use visualization tools to show them what they said might be what they want, and they'll look at something and say, I know I said that, but how does this work? I know I said blue, not that blue, but at some point it gels, and at that point we have a clear blueprint to build.
Mm-hmm. Where do you want to be 5 years from now?
I love what I do. You know,
About growing, or is it about taking on more interesting work? Where do you want to be as a company?
We're very happy. You know, growth is good for our staff. Bigger projects are always better. But the work is really important. To make sure that we plan properly and deliver properly takes precedence. A couple of years ago, there was someone from a large consulting firm talking about our business, looked at me and sneered and said, "You know, you're just a lifestyle company," which he meant in an absolutely derogatory manner. And I took it as a compliment.
So I hear that. And so how would you characterize the key values of the organization?
It's really about the customer and delivering a solution that meets their needs.
So how do you go about hiring someone? What do you look for more than anything else?
For our developers, it's really just a passion for writing code and enjoying it. And for our analysts, the ability to communicate and work with stakeholders to try to extract the requirements.
Right.
It's all about communications.
What would you say the toughest thing you've ever accomplished is, Wayne?
Well, keeping a company growing for 32 years, it is a marathon. It's not a sprint.
Right.
And even though we do the same thing we did 30 years ago, there's been a lot of change.
I'll bet. How about your proudest moment up till now?
I have a great family, and I have a great company, and I'm just
at the end of the day, family and company.
I really couldn't be happier.
Good for you. What's the website address?
Infoconcepts.com.
infoconcepts.com?
Yep.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Wayne Beekman, who's the co-founder of Information Concepts. I'd like to thank my co-host, Les Smolin. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us for this segment is Hector Velez, who's the EVP of Business Development for Hire Strategy. What is Hire Strategy, Hector?
Peter, Hire Strategy is the largest locally based recruiting firm in the D.C. metro area.
So you guys are in the business of helping find people for companies.
Human capital, or hiring employers.
And what makes your company special?
I think it's a customer experience. I think we certainly have a lot of competition in the market, and our competitors may be representing the same product, if you will, but with Hire Strategy, our clients have a different value-add experience.
Mm-hmm. And what do you like most about your job?
I like the people aspect of it, that at the end of the day, we're helping employers and people create the ideal match to support their mission.
Mm-hmm. How can someone find out about you?
www.hirestrategy.com.
And by phone, how could they reach you?
703-547-6700.
And why should somebody call you instead of somebody else?
I'll keep it simple. We've been in this market 20 years. The founding partners of Hire Strategy have been together about 18 years. What that tells you is our strength, stability, and continuity. We know the D.C. market very well.
And because of that, you can help people find really good homes with really good companies.
We bring a totally consultative approach to our business versus a traditional.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Hector Velez, who's the EVP of Business Development for Hire Strategy. I'm Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and that has been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Bernhardt Wealth Management Office, helping to make work optional for you. I'm Peter Schwartz, your host. I'm joined by my co-host, Les Smolin. And for this segment, we have Vijay Lakshman, who's the CEO of a company called Brilliant Entertainment. What is Brilliant Entertainment, Vijay?
Brilliant Entertainment is a full-service strategic consulting company that helps people currently in the video game space learn how to maximize their business, avoid pitfalls, and create real revenue.
So what does that mean to the layperson? You help guys that are really talented at making games run their business?
That's exactly right. We have creating games is an exceptionally difficult industry to be in. There's a lot of learning that goes on, and the learning isn't always transferred from studio to studio. So they hire people like me to come in and help create methodologies and help create practices that result in better games.
In better games. So how did you get interested in gaming?
Well, I was actually a funny story. I was on my way to medical school, and I took a summer job at a game company. I was lucky enough to work with some incredibly talented people. That game got Game of the Year, and I never ended up showing up for my first day of classes at med school.
Your father must have been thrilled.
I didn't tell my dad. I waited until my sister got accepted, then I told him.
Seriously?
Not days, weeks.
It was weeks, many weeks.
What was his reaction?
It's one of those situations where the chair tilts to the left, and now my sister is his favorite kid. He's very happy for me.
But you had the good fortune of succeeding early.
Yeah.
What's it take to be a good gamer?
Well, there's a difference between a good gamer and a good game developer.
A good game developer.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily a good gamer, but as a good game developer, I think it's an insane attention to detail and just a desire to be organized.
Really?
I don't know what it is. I have an OCD when it comes to things that are not aligned correctly, like these, coasters on a table and things like that.
When did you realize you had that gift for doing that?
I learned on the job as a game developer, and when the first game did so well and we got it out on time, I had taken it for granted that that's how things worked. And then as I moved in the industry and started seeing how other game developers worked and how game development went, I realized that I was lucky, I think, to have been partnered with some great people, learned some great practices early on, but also had this desire to be organized, and this feeling of things out of place didn't sit well.
Where did that first start showing up for you? This attention to detail and the desire to be organized. How young were you when looking back?
Definitely, it started with my martial arts career. When I was 10 years old, my father enrolled me in a martial arts class, and I think that discipline, that learning, that repetitive nature of martial arts.
And you just kind of liked it?
I loved it. If I rewound my life, I probably would have gone to the military.
Really?
Yeah, I think that's the path that I probably missed for some reason.
What was going on for you at that age so that he's felt enrolling you in the martial arts was an important thing for you, regardless of what the outcome was?
No. My family had moved to Virginia, and it was during the time of the strife between the U.S. and Iran. And there was a lot of bullying and stuff going on for any kids that were perceived as Iranian and I'm, you know, from India, but I think the distinction was lost on many people.
Do you recall what it was like coming home having your butt kicked?
Oh yeah, you never forget the smell of blood, but it's a coppery kind of feeling. But you know, in the end of the day, as you started training and you start learning how to defend yourself, you start realizing that it's really fear that really hurts. It's not the actual fighting or anything else.
It's the fear of fear.
It's the fear of fear. And once you get over that, I think you're opening yourself up to a much larger world.
But not many people actually do get over that. Most people actually make a lot of decisions based on fear. You don't. So what do you credit that to?
A really, really tough karate instructor.
Really?
who made us, you know, my family's one that faces things head on. My karate instructor is one who reinforced that ideal and that moral that we take things on and we face them and we get over them. And I think that is a fundamental positive nature kind of thing we need to instill in kids.
So how young were you when you developed your first game?
So my first game was when I was about 21.
So then what happened? You had that early success. Then what followed?
We continued to create games. My career sort of skyrocketed, things sort of led to more and more creative opportunities, and you know, it's accumulated now in me writing my first novel and releasing it.
Uh-huh. So tell us about your first novel.
So my first novel is Mythborn. I have meticulously crafted a world.
Meticulously crafted. There's that detail orientation again.
and I spent 10 years creating this backstory of this world before I started writing about it. And have now finished 200,000 words, two novels worth, launched it on Amazon. It's gotten rave reviews. I think that we're going to be negotiating for a television series on it.
Why write this book? Why?
I love fantasy. I love reading. I've read every science fiction and fantasy book in my high school library. I got to a point where I just didn't have things to read, and I wanted to write something after a while that reflected and paid homage to some of the best authors that are out there, but also my own take on what I thought could be done.
So what are some of the best authors out there in your opinion?
Well, I love Robin Hobb. I love some of the stuff coming out by Marcos Clouse. There's more than a dozen that I could name.
Uh-huh.
I think what's most important is that when I looked at the fantasy and the writing that I didn't like, what I found was that people created these archetypes and these stereotypes of characters that were good and evil, and I felt like fantasy lacked a realism, for lack of a better word. Fantasy lacked a realism that we could bring where people had real motivations.
And so this book is about a bad guy.
This book is about the birth of a bad guy.
The birth of a bad guy.
It starts the last 7 days of an apprentice assassin's life. And following his descent to whatever his end is what this book covers. These 200,000 words cover a week.
So why is that so? Wow, 200,000 words for a week.
A week of someone's life.
That's pretty detailed.
It's pretty detailed.
Why is that so fascinating to you, a descent?
Because I think that people write the arc of the hero very easily. It's mm-hmm. very easy to understand. What I don't think people do well or have the opportunity to do is to mark or to write a real character who ends up becoming a hero but may not have that shining ideal in his mind or this stalwart heart. My karate instructor told me once, he said, heroes aren't people who will just blaze in blindly. They're the ones who know that they could die and still go in.
Right.
Right. And I think that's what's interesting to me.
Uh-huh. And what did you learn about writing this book? About yourself? About life? What?
I think that the writing itself taught me how important it is to be organized.
Just reinforcing the same lesson.
I, unlike everything else in my life, I wrote this without an outline. I didn't write anything at first. I did the world study first, so I understood the world. But when it came to the actual writing of the book, the plot, I didn't write a single outline out. I just kept it all in my head. I'll never do that again.
Yeah,
it was impossibly hard. Harder than it needed to be.
So
the lesson you're learning here is that when you're taking on or taking on a new challenge in this regard, that there's something you need to do first before you actually just do it?
I think that diving in is all. I'll never tell someone not to do that. Dive in. Dive in and get your feet wet. You know, in over your head is always a great way to learn. But I'm 46 years old. I've done 85 video game titles. I've generated over $1 billion in revenue. I've graduated from the greatest schools and been lucky to work with great, great people. And I still messed up on this in terms of you can never be too organized, I think, sometimes when it comes to an endeavor of this size. And I think the problem was you step into something and not knowing how deep it is. And I just didn't realize when you're going to write a novel how much work it is to write a novel.
This is your second appearance on the show. And I remember the first time around we talked about the impact of gaming on education. Spend a little bit of time on that.
I think that the U.S. educational system today could use a lot of help. And I think that a great place to start is in the engagement of students. And the way students are engaging today is through games. That's their medium. Our medium might have been TV. Maybe someone else's medium might have been radio. If you go back a 1,000 years or 100,000 years, it might have been campfire stories. But it all came down to narrative and context. And I think games do a great job of creating a context around which a student can learn something. And once you engage them, you can teach them anything.
Do you have some evidence of that? Children learning this way?
There's now all kinds of evidence that has been done through various national studies and surveys that let people understand that there's an absolute correlation to doing something experientially in a virtual environment where you can afford to make a mistake and then having a positive outcome to that when you exercise that same behavior in real life.
Well, that tells me then that this applies in professional settings as well.
Absolutely. I think that anytime someone can fail without huge consequence, they get comfortable with the idea of failing, and that brings me back to the fear of fear. When you're scared about failing, you're scared about the failing itself, not the outcome of the failure.
Right.
So once you get used to that fear, the failure goes away because you're not afraid of taking a chance.
You mentioned you have two kids.
That's right.
Bookends, I think, as you call them, one being
15 and one is 9 months.
I'm sure you talk to them about a lot of different things. You probably actually get into the gaming things with them as well. But if there's something to pass on to them from all of this that you're doing, and you found your place now as a dad, as a writer, an author as well, what is it for them that you want them to be able to take away from all this?
If I could tell them one thing, it would be don't build the same staircase your dad did. Climb his staircase and then build the next step. It's a much, much easier to work and climb up on what someone else has already learned and to step forward from that point than trying to build something from the very bottom and, reinvent the wheel. There's no reason to do that.
To stand on your shoulders and create your own success from that.
Yeah.
What's your proudest moment up till now, Vijay?
You know, I am so happy that I'm blessed with two great sons and a great wife, and I'm absolutely thankful for that. Finishing this book has been a huge milestone for me. It's 10 years in the making. It's 200,000 words, like I said before, that is two novels worth. And I spent my entire, I think, life preparing to write this novel. And I'm really excited now that it's out on Amazon. It's out on Barnes & Noble. And I'm excited that I hope people get a chance to enjoy this new universe that I've created.
Well, thank you. What's the website address for the book?
www.mythbornbook.com. The book's name is Mythborn, MYTHBORN, and it's mythbornbook.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Vijay Lakshman, who's the CEO of a company called Brilliant Entertainment. I'd like to thank Les Smolin, my co-host, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us for this segment is Kimberly Stevens, who's the Business Development Manager of a company called CBiz. What is CBiz, Kimberly?
CBiz is a national provider of services in the areas of finance and employee benefits.
What would you say makes your company special?
The fact that we're able to bring people together across a wide spectrum of capabilities and services to provide solid solutions to our customers.
So you help your customers find people that will help them with their things that they do for their customers.
That's exactly it.
And what's the role you play with the company?
I serve as a business development manager, and in that capacity, I work to identify people who may have needs for the services that we offer. I meet with them, listen to what the issues are that they might have, and think of the people that we have in our midst to help them.
Why do you like your job?
I like it for that very reason. I enjoy meeting people and getting to know what their business is and working to connect them with people who can help them meet their goals.
It's what makes you so good at it?
What is helpful is that I genuinely care. And I do want them to have success in their business. And I'm also very excited about the talent and capabilities that we have to offer. And so since I'm able to believe in that and care about the outcome, it helps me to be effective in what I do.
Great. And I understand somebody who would be interested to reach you could find you at www.cbiz.com-midatlantic.com. Is that true?
That's correct.
Okay. We've been speaking with Kimberly Stevens, who's the business development manager for a company called CBiz. And I'm Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and that was your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the offices of Bernhardt Wealth Management, helping to make work optional for you. This is Peter Schwartz, your host, and I'm joined by my co-host, Les Smolin. And for this segment, we have Mark Chichester, who is the president of a company called Atlas Research. What is Atlas Research, Mark?
We're a public sector management consulting firm with a focus in the federal healthcare market. Lots of work for the Department of Veterans Affairs and increasingly for Health and Human Services across the various agencies there.
So give us an example of your work product in the federal government.
Absolutely. I mean, we're proud to be the lead contractor supporting the Department of Veterans Affairs in the presidentially announced goal of ending homelessness by 2015.
And how does your program or your company affect that?
Well, we work across a variety of portfolio projects that include consolidating, streamlining, and providing technology support for benefits information access. So, you know, one of the problems that you have when you have a system like the VA where stakeholders in that system, i.e. veterans, homeless veterans, receive services from the VA. They might receive it from a local agency, mm-hmm. from a state-level agency. How do you coordinate that? So we're leading the effort to bring that into a single platform and share that information. We also are part of a very ambitious initiative targeting 25 cities across the country to end homelessness. So we're convening teams, multi-sector teams at the national, state, local level in these cities to bring to bear resources in a strategic way.
And I can't help but see your passion in your face for this. What makes the work so important to you?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've spent most of my career in the government and nonprofit sectors. I'm by nature sort of a mission-oriented guy. Nothing makes me more gets me more excited and passionate than the opportunity to go and lead a company that is both profitable and growing, but most importantly, that's impacting and changing lives on a day-to-day basis. And we have wonderful opportunities to do that.
When did it become important to you to be mission-oriented?
I think it's something that begins with family.
Did you have a sense of this early on?
Absolutely. I mean,
how early?
It's you know, I would say as early as I can remember attending school, grandparents and parents saying, "You have an obligation to give back." And I think in the African American community in particular, I had some pretty unique opportunities. And so, it's funny, as I got to high school and then to college, I was struck by the history of our name, Chichester, its obvious English origins, and I looked at the coat of arms and I sort of laughed. It says firm en foi, which is firm in faith. And it occurred to me I want to develop one for my family, just make up our own, you know, sort of motto, if you will. And so that was, you know, faith, knowledge, humility, and service. And that's sort of the sequence through which we try to raise our kids. They say, you know, be firm in faith.
Faith, knowledge.
Yeah, it's like, you know, be faith in God, something greater and higher than you.
Right.
You know, but faith, as we know from some of the events playing out around the world, and the absence of knowledge and education can be a pretty dangerous thing.
Right.
So faith,
right.
knowledge. If you've got faith and you've got you know, knowledge and education, you can get pretty haughty, right? So there's, you know, humility, and then lastly, service. So you take all those things and you go out and serve.
So that's a nice cycle that can repeat over and over again.
Yes,
for you?
Absolutely.
And is that the way you run your business?
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. Early on in the business, because I was new to the entrepreneurial thing, I was largely deferential to my current partner and a former partner that had been with us. And there were times when I was not as assertive as I am now about those values. Mm-hmm. And we both agree that it's good that those things have come forward in the business, and we wouldn't be here without it.
What changed that made that happen for you?
We went through some adversity. We're challenged, and I think when you face adversity, you find out what people are really made of. And in that process, one of the partners, who was also a dear friend, exited. The two of us, Ryung and myself, remained, and we weren't close friends. We've now become friends and brothers.
So you discovered through adversity something within you that was already there?
Something I think that was there, but that was looking for a test to fully manifest itself. And so, you know, the difficult decisions, conversations that you have to have, both with folks inside the business, as well as your family. I mean, my wife is looking, and the notion of risk, you know,
sure,
is not something easily embraced.
Yeah, so I was going to ask, what was at risk for you?
Everything. You know,
isn't that interesting, though, that the solution to your adversity was values-based, not tactical?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, in the depths of crisis and challenge, I think it's character that drives
every
success.
Time.
I spent time at the Aspen Institute before we started the business, and you know there were a lot of very wealthy folks there that participated in our programs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, without singling anyone out, I mean, there were folks there that were enormously successful tactically, strategically. But something separated in certain instances with respect to character and values. And I always noted that folks paid a price for that. So there's success, and then there's compromising values and what your character is and what you've been taught. And I think, you know, no matter how successful financially you might be and how recognized your brand might be, in the absence of, I think, keeping firm in that belief in those structures is paramount.
Yeah. Where did that show up for you when you were young? Because you mentioned you came from a fourth-generation family.
Yeah, fourth-generation.
Fairly extended family.
Large extended family, heavy emphasis, on family. And so it was fully expected that you went out and you represented that name in the community, at your school. I then was fortunate enough to have a Quaker values-based education at Sidwell Friends here, and that, you know, that just furthered, I think, something that had already been.
Did you know that at that time?
I had no idea at the time at Sidwell. Had no idea. And it's only with the benefit of hindsight that I fully appreciate that. In fact, most of my classmates would tell you I was sort of a late bloomer, precocious, very immature. And I go back to reunions and such, and people say, Mark, what the heck happened to you?
So what the heck happened to you?
There you go.
You grow up.
Yeah, it does.
You know, and I think, you know, I became a young parent. I was a dad at the age of 23, and at the same time moved abroad to live in Korea for an academic year following law school.
Mm.
I think those two things, you know, being a parent at 23 when I'm not even who I'm going to be at that point. So having to figure out who and what I am and at the same time be responsible for raising a young child and doing that in a completely alien environment where I don't speak the language, don't know the mm-hmm. culture.
So you were sharing with us in the green room your love of music, in particular jazz.
Absolutely.
Tell us about that.
Well, my father was a jazz musician, and my earliest remembrances of him were, you know, bent over his records, playing records, some of his own performance, some of others like Miles and Coltrane. And, you know, I didn't appreciate the music at the time, but my father was, by playing the music, exposing me to it, talking about it, he was developing, I don't even think knowingly, an ear for music that's come, I think, you know, sort of full fruition now, and it manifests itself across other parts of my life.
And you use a musical term to describe the way you operate in your business, and it's called the inner ear.
Yeah, it's this inner ear. I think oftentimes as leaders, we can be duped when we find ourselves in a moment of adversity, not trusting our inner selves and that inner ear. What that lesson from my dad and that experience taught me is to trust that. And I've had it affirmed that when you don't trust it, things tend to go awry. And I've had some experience with that as well.
Is he surprised at your success today?
I don't think he's surprised. I think he viewed me as a talented individual, but I think he was concerned that my precociousness might take me in another direction. And he's happy to see me appreciating music and that I attribute his, you know, his contributions to my life as being critical to my success.
Staying on the jazz metaphor here, you're working close proximity to your partner, apparently.
Absolutely. So,
and so how are you guys a kind of a duet?
We sit not even five feet from one another. And so on any given morning, within 15, 20 seconds, I know his mood. He knows what my mood is for the day. I know if he's got a problem with me. He knows if I have a problem with him. We know if one or the other is upset about something in the business with someone else. We never allow ourselves to get out of sync. It's almost like seeing two performers, you know, in a jazz performance, and you see them just kind of look at each other, and they nod, and you know when they're coming in on a particular beat or something like that. It's very much like that in the day-to-day of the business, and so we're able to self-correct almost with a glance, without writing or necessarily speaking sometimes, and being close and intimate and up and personal like that helps.
And because you're able to do that with a partner, what possibilities does that create for the business?
Oh, it's tremendous. I mean, if you talk to our employees, I think to a man and woman, they tell you that either of us as the leader of the company would fail in running the business.
Right.
Either, in other words, they'd say, Mark, you'd do great things, but you'd take the company this way. Ryung, you are talented. You'd do great things, very different from Mark. What we continually hear is that somewhere between the two of you, you've created something that's really unique and special.
What's the toughest thing you've ever accomplished, Mark?
Wow. I think actually the transition to a for-profit business that I own. You know, it's all on the line, my reputation at stake. I can't blame the incompetent or visionless boss up the line.
Right. How about your proudest moment?
Proudest moment, I'd have to say the birth of my oldest son and his graduation from my alma mater a few years ago.
What's the website address?
www.atlasresearch.us, as in United States.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Mark Chichester, who is the president of Atlas Research. I'd like to thank Les Smolin for co-hosting with me today. We've had a great lineup of guests on our show, including Brian Karlish, who is the co-founder and CEO of Buchanan and Edwards, Wayne Beekman, the co-founder of Information Concepts, Vijay Lakshman, CEO of Brilliant Entertainment, and finally, once again, Mark Chichester, the president of Atlas Research. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be talking to you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
When I served in Iraq and Afghanistan, my buddies and I would do anything for each other. That's important whether you're in a firefight or fighting to regain your life. When I came home injured, there are people I can count on, like DAV.
DAV, Disabled American Veterans, stands behind America's veterans to make their transition back home easier with free services and help getting the benefits they've earned. Help us fulfill the promise to our men and women who served. Go to DAV.org to learn more.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and
this
Federal
paid
News
commercial
Radio.
May not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take